From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If the public and Washington have anything to say about it, corporate criminals will go directly to jail. They will not pass go, and they will certainly not collect $200. America is as mad as hell, and many are cheering as corporate executives are marched off in handcuffs. In this hour, crime and punishment. We ask, what is justice for white-collar crime? We begin in Washington, where tomorrow President Bush is expected to sign the corporate reform bill. David Hilzenrath is covering the accounting scandals for the Washington Post, and I asked him what the bill's key points are.
I'd say one of the central elements is a new oversight board for the accounting industry that would sweep away the industry's system of self-regulation. It would have the power to make auditing rules and to enforce them. That's a central element. The bill would give investors more time to file private lawsuits to recoup money lost to accounting fraud. On the subject of auditing, the bill prohibits auditors from providing consulting services to the same companies they're responsible for auditing unless they first get approval from a committee of outside directors. And some consulting services are prohibited altogether. One of the more high-profile provisions would increase criminal penalties for various types of white-collar crime, and those are some of the key provisions.
What kind of criminal penalties?
People who deceive the investing public could face up to 20 years in prison, but those provisions are, I think, an interesting microcosm of the bill. The penalties make potent political symbols, Michael, but some lawyers question their significance. The tough new prison sentences only kick in if people are convicted, and lawyers say it could still be difficult for prosecutors to get convictions under the law's burden of proof.
So the idea of putting in these tough penalties is at least have some language saying there will be punishment for corporate chief executives involved in malfeasance, but the reality is that it's just a political gesture because it's unlikely that many CEOs or senior accountants will ever actually have to face jail time.
Well, the penalties are intended to serve as a deterrent, and we'll have to see how it all plays out. But take the requirement that chief executives certify corporate financial reports. The executives could only be held liable for knowingly or willfully signing false statements. So they could still claim ignorance as a defense, and in securities cases, proving state of mind has historically been a difficult challenge for prosecutors.
Do you think that the rest of the bill really has sufficient teeth to make a dent into the current corporate practice?
Well, it's worth noting that there were some significant compromises along the way to this remarkable, almost unanimous vote in the U.S. Congress.
Now, you say it's remarkable because it was unanimous.
It's rare to see such unanimity on a major piece of legislation. But as for these compromises, disciplinary proceedings against accountants could remain confidential until appeals run their course. That could make them less open, less transparent than administrative proceedings now carried out by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Similarly, problems uncovered in routine inspections of accounting firms could be kept under wraps for at least a year, giving accounting firms a chance to fix them. And that could make these inspections, this new oversight system, even less illuminating than a system it was meant to replace, a system in which accounting firms were periodically peer-reviewed by other accounting firms.
The politics of this was unanimous. I mean, was there much of any kind of internal debate about protecting constituencies? I mean, the kind of thing that goes on all the time when a major bill is working its way across the Hill.
There was a lot of debate along the way, and there was a lot of compromise early on. In the end, the momentum for reform became overwhelming, and even lawmakers who were troubled by provisions of this bill were afraid to vote against it. The conveniently timed revelation of accounting shenanigans at WorldCom, the number two long-distance company, gave a real boost to this legislation in the final stages. And with the stock prices plunging, with investor confidence evaporating, lawmakers felt that they needed to do something, even if they were uncomfortable with the specifics of this solution.
What's the feeling on the Hill about who's going to end up being able to make the most political hay out of all this? Tomorrow the president's going to sign, and you know he's going to lean in towards the camera and look in charge. But do the lawmakers on the Hill think that they're actually going to get the most benefit out of this?
Well, I think every politician in Washington, with few exceptions, will take credit for this, even if they opposed it or stood on the sidelines at an earlier stage.
So who's actually, now that the bill is going to pass in law, who's going to have oversight of this, the SEC?
The signing of this bill at the White House won't be the end of the process. Now it's the SEC's job to write rules, to implement the law, and to choose the people to serve on this five-member oversight board for the accounting industry. And all of that bears watching. As you know, right now the SEC is itself under scrutiny. A number of members of Congress are calling for the resignation of the SEC's chairman, Harvey Pitt, a longtime lawyer for the accounting industry. And this now becomes, in large part, Harvey Pitt's responsibility.
The rules on punishment, these are just suggestions. How specific are they?
They specify maximum sentences for an array of offenses, and the maximums vary from offense to offense. In one particular case, there's a new criminal provision, a new felony for securities fraud. I think that the maximum penalty there is 25 years in prison.
David Hilzenrath, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Hilzenrath is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from Washington, D.C. We're talking tonight on Point listeners about hard time for white-collar crime. Is robbing the candy store the same as robbing the pension fund? And should the punishment be the same? Where's the line between bad ethics and criminal behavior? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in this conversation in Santa Monica, California, is Jennifer Arlen, a law professor at New York University. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
And with me in the studio is Mark Seltzer, who's a former federal prosecutor in both Miami and Boston, who's now an attorney with the firm Holland & Knight, where he actually represents corporate executives who are being investigated by the government. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And in the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Michael.
Let me turn to you, Jennifer Arlen, first. We were just listening to David Hilzenrath, and he sounded a slightly skeptical note there that the SEC is going to have oversight of these of this new bill and these laws that are meant to make corporate executives behave slightly better, and the deterrence there is punishment. He's slightly skeptical about its enforcement. Are you?
Oh, I agree with him. He's right to be skeptical. We need only look back to what happened in 1995 when Congress enacted the Private Securities Reform Act. And the idea there was to cut back on private suits but empower the SEC. And in particular, the SEC was given some additional weapons to use against accountants. Accountants were required to report wrongdoing by their firms, by the firms they were auditing, to the board of directors, and if the board didn't act, to report to the SEC, and if they failed to do so, the SEC could punish them. I'm not aware of the SEC using that power to punish a single one of the big five firms, and they've punished only a handful of other firms for failure to file what's known as 10A reports.
Mark Seltzer, with this skepticism being expressed all around, I mean, big headlines, corporate reform, but people in the know saying, well, how likely is it that anything will be done? Now, you've both prosecuted white-collar crime, and now you are you represent corporate executives. How difficult is it to actually get a real criminal prosecution up and running?
It's very difficult. An investigation of fraud usually takes some 2 to 3 years to complete. You have to remember that prosecutors have to establish the state of mind of the defendant or the individual under investigation. And the indicia of fraud has to resonate in front of a jury. So a prosecutor is not looking so much at is there a violation of a regulation, is there a violation of an SEC rule. The question from them can I convince a jury by proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And to do that, they've got to establish indicia of fraud that will resonate in front of a jury and will establish what was in the state of mind of the charged executive at the time the offense was completed. Now, that's a very difficult burden to establish.
Well, how do you do that?
You do that, in effect, through the words of the defendant. The words of the defendant in certifying to purportedly false documents. The words of the defendant in moving funds offshore.
Where do you find these words? Are these in letters and memorandums back to the accounting firms, to his presentations to the board of directors? What?
Typically, at least in the traditional white-collar crime, you find it in certifications made under the pains and penalty of perjury. For example, statements provided to a financial institution to obtain a loan. Any kind of representations that are required by law. And typically what a prosecutor will do is he will start with that representation and examine the paper trail to establish whether the facts that underlie that representation are false and whether they were made with knowledge and intent to deceive the institution or to deceive regulators. That is a substantial burden to establish. Remember, these executives, for the most part, had devoted their professional lives to these corporations. And they will get up on the witness stand and they will testify that it was never their intent to defraud the institution that they gave their life's work to at the expense of shareholders, at the expense of innocent employees and executives of the company.
When you're dealing with them in the courtroom, do you ever get a chance to do some kind of pyrotechnical moment where you say, no, this is a lie, or is it equally an unfolding of paper to try and prove their state of mind?
Well, it's a very good question because in a jury trial, you have to make these cold and very dry documents come alive. And you typically don't have that Perry Mason moment like you saw in the O.J. Simpson case. In a very laborious fashion, typically over several months, prosecutors have to establish this paper trail. And remember, these transactions in isolation are typically legitimate transactions. You've got to prove that the transaction was entered into with intent to defraud, intent to deceive, and that the state of mind of the defendant at the time was to hurt the bank, to hurt the institution, at the expense of the institution and to his own advantage. That's a very difficult burden.
Well, it seems to me that the legislation should have been dealing with that problem, you know, lightening that burden of proof rather than going for the headline grabbing, you know, well, if you can prove it, they get 25 years in prison. But I want to bring Jack Beatty in, our news analyst in Vermont, on this. Jack, we're talking about the process at the moment, how you might get a conviction. But realistically, when you're dealing with an individual, what is the punishment that fits this kind of crime? In your view?
Oh, gosh, I practically, I can just imagine the kind of lawyer. I think our guest is an example that these people would hire. They would get the best kind of counsel. And then statutorily, I just don't know what these statutes say about SEC violations. Of course, now they're going to be severe. But, you know, I was talking to a lawyer about this, and he said, look at Enron. He says, they're going to get into a kind of Mexican standoff here. The accountant is going to say, well, the lawyer okayed it. And the lawyer is going to say, well, I was just doing what the accountant told me. And the board is going to say, we did what our lawyer said. And the CEO is, in other words, it's going to go around and around in this kind of professional reference. And it's just going to be very hard. How does that model of state of mind fit a thing like Enron, either of you?
Jennifer Arlen.
Well, one of the serious problems that other people have raised about using criminal sanctions is you have this combination of a very high burden of culpability, of scienter, and a high burden of proof. And in many of these complex corporate frauds, it may be very hard because often it's a lot of little decisions. I think Enron's a classic example, which is, my understanding is there were a lot of little decisions that Enron, being so huge, could argue each individual one was not material. You know, they were hedging it a little here, cooking the books a little, but it wasn't material.
Jennifer, right? I'm going to ask you to pause there. We're going to pick that thought up after the break. Music always means we're coming into the break. And we'll be going to your calls. We want to get away from the strict legalese and talk a bit about the punishment that fits these particular crimes. You're listening to On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. In this hour, we're talking about corporate crime, corporate punishment, the corporate responsibility bill is, corporate reform bill is going to be signed by President Bush tomorrow. We're talking about the penalties that might deter corporate crime in the future that are included in that bill. We're talking with Mark Seltzer, who's with me here in the studio. He's a lawyer, with our news analyst, Jack Beatty, who's in Vermont Public Radio studios. And just before the break, we were talking with Jennifer Arlen, who's a law professor at New York University. Jennifer, do you just want to pick up your point about the Enron situation and how unlikely it is that any executives are ever likely to ever have to face the prospect of some kind of jail time for what went on there?
Well, the difficulty is that they might argue that they will try to separate out each of the decisions they made and get the jury to focus on them individually and say that, no, this decision wasn't material, it wasn't significant, so it wasn't really fraud, whereas the problem is that they made a series of decisions that if you add it all up, meant that the company's financial statements bore no relationship to the real financial picture for the firm. But they will try to get the jury to not focus on the whole but a piece if they even go to trial. One would expect that won't happen.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Barbara is calling from Duluth, Minnesota.
Hello. Well, I'm almost 60, and so having lived these many years, I don't think I'm that unusual in that I live in an average neighborhood, and I've had my car stolen once. I did have my house burglarized once, and I've had a purse stolen a couple of times over the years. But I also have recently lost about 65% of my IRA money. Now, I'm near retirement. I only make $20,000 a year, and all I've got to fall back on is a pretty small Social Security, so my IRA really matters to me. I feel more robbed and more affected by what's happened with all these companies and how it's affected my my personal IRA savings than I have by any of these other incidents. And I would really like to see these people do jail time, but after listening to your discussion, I would prefer even more that somehow they have to give back that money. Now, you know, people will argue and say it's the greedy investors that got themselves into this position, but as you know, we were lied to a lot, and I think making them return the money is something that maybe you could get more effect on, although I'd love to see them go to jail. The person that stole my car went to jail, and that was a pretty minor thing, you know, overall. So that's my opinion. And
okay, Barbara, I'm going to put your – stay with us. I'm going to ask Mark Seltzer to comment on that because you've worked both sides of the aisle.
I think the likelihood of any executive in a complex securities fraud prosecution going to jail for a substantial period of time is a very small one. There's a greater likelihood, though, between the pressure of civil litigation where shareholders like Barber get together and bring a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, on behalf of the shareholders of a company, alleging that they had been lied to, that the duty of loyalty and care that they were owed was not demonstrated by corporate executives. That may be the preferable route to getting restitution, to get it to be made whole, as opposed to relying on the Department of Justice and a grand jury investigation and the SEC to go through this long dance to make investors like Barbara whole.
Barbara, would restitution satisfy you, or would you also like to see some jail time?
Well, restitution is real important, you know, when someone's in my position. I would like to say, though, that that's a lot trickier than what the person that was talking about it just said, because if I'm in some a lot of mutual funds and also in index funds, all of these companies have affected me, but it's kind of hard to parse out, you know, how to to get all that information.
Not to mention the time you might have to wait to actually get your restitution.
And the other thing is, you're darn right I'd like to see them go to jail. But, you know, at the very least, I would like to see, you know, somehow restitution required. And frankly, you know, I think it would be really hard for me, given, you know, mutual funds and all that kind of investment that I have rather than a lot of individual companies, but those were also affected, obviously. Even if I don't get it back, I'd sure like to see them not be able to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
Jennifer, did you want to
minimum requirement.
I hear
jail would be frosting, and it's too bad that there isn't a more equitable system for people who steal a car or a purse and people who you know, really screw up a person's whole retirement plan.
Jennifer Arlen, did I hear you there on the line?
Yes. Barbara, I think, has hit the nail on the head that I think many people feel, that these people who have sacrificed people's retirements and thus, for example, the money they saved for their medical bills when they're older, because, of course, we've cut back on Medicaid and things like that, that these people who have sacrificed other people's futures should really have to pay and should not be able to, you know, stay wealthy off of, you know, by hurting other people. The problem is that thanks to Congress's actions in the 1990s, even if Barbara wanted to sue, it would be very hard for her to recover anything. Congress has made it much more difficult to file private actions against business executives. And even if those actions are filed, the shareholders get, you know, pennies on the dollar of what they lost, and the executives are permitted to shelter much of their income, even if you win. They can shelter it in bankruptcy. They shelter it overseas. Congress is doing nothing to make sure that executives can't really shelter their money.
Well, here's an interesting point. Mark Seltzer, you were a federal prosecutor in Miami. You did drug cases. You know, you go down to South Florida, and there's always a site along the coast are the impound harbors where various yachts belonging to people who are running cocaine up from South America. This is all part of their penalty. They may be in jail. They may have escaped the country, but at least their expensive yacht is still here. Why is there nothing in this legislation, did anybody argue for it, to, you know, seize the assets of people who would otherwise be able to shelter them, just as Jennifer was describing?
I'm sure that Congress made the asset forfeiture laws available and applicable to these kinds of violations. The issue, though, is, and the challenge for prosecutors, that they still have to establish a paper trail. They still have to trace the ill-gotten gains, the ill-gotten proceeds to those properties. So the prosecutors still have that same challenge as they had in the mid-'80s, bringing prosecutions against narcotics traffickers.
But there is a difference, which is that RICO, which is the anti-racketeering law, does apply to securities fraud. But civil RICO, private plaintiff's ability to use RICO, does not apply to securities fraud. That was part of what Congress did. So this powerful tool, which could really be used by private plaintiffs, Congress specifically excluded securities fraud from this.
Oh, boy.
804. Jack, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Barbara, just to listen to that comment of Jennifer's, Barbara is the victim of capitalism. She's the victim of speculation, and she's above all the victim of the grip of campaign contributions on politicians, because these security laws changes that would prevent her from getting redress were no doubt lavishly paid for by Wall Street and corporate interests. And that remains the, you know, we haven't struck at that kind of thing. I haven't heard anyone even raise this. And this reminds me a little bit. I was looking for precedents about this. And I was going back to looking at the Pecora hearings in the 30s about the collapse of the stock market. And they gut a few people, but basically they really didn't do much other than sort of shame them. Well, Huey Long made a sarcastic comment about it. The one ones that the people they were getting were small fry. He said, first we prod them, kick them, poke them, and make sure they're dead. Then, once we're sure of that, we all shout together, let's go after them. And we do.
Huey Long. Now, he knew something about fraud. But I'm just wondering, we're really focused here on very legal and specific things. And I just like to expand it out more and just talk about the notion of punishment for a moment. Because, you know, in our society, there are a lot of people who, maybe not necessarily public radio listeners, who believe that you must have strong punishment as a deterrence. And if we're looking to clean up the system, isn't strong individual punishment, and I don't mean taking away money, I'm talking about what Barbara was talking about, that sense of punishment as society's retribution for a criminal act against society. Jack, is strong punishment required here?
Well, you know, we've had episodes in American life where punishment was not paid out, and they've left people feeling incomplete. I think Watergate was an example of that, the Ford pardon. You can argue it either way, but not to see Richard Nixon brought to trial and actually having to hear the evidence against him and so on. I think something was missing there, and I'm afraid this is going to be another one of those episodes. And, you know, we've outlasted shame. Shame was yesterday in America. And I don't know that Andrew Fastow, who is the chief financial wizard at Enron, I don't know that he's feeling any shame. There was one man at Enron, a vice president, who out of shame killed himself. And maybe that's a course that others should follow.
Mark, what do you feel about real punishment? I mean, you tried to get it when you were a prosecutor. Now, presumably, I know you've got attorney-client privilege, but presumably you're trying to make sure your clients don't go to jail. What do you think about this notion? I mean, and what kind of jail time should it be?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, when I was a prosecutor, I was seeking substantial jail time, and now as a defense lawyer, I'm looking for every mitigating circumstance, and that's the great irony. My view is that many of these issues are public policy issues and that the SEC should be addressing this kind of corporate misconduct from a regulatory perspective. But in a courtroom where the rules of criminal procedure, the rules of evidence, and the constitutional protections apply, a violation of a rule, a violation of a regulation is not a violation of law. And we cannot forget that Every defendant is presumed innocent. Every defendant is entitled to these constitutional protections. And ultimately, a jury will be the final spokesman. Whether or not harsh criminal penalties will be a deterrent, I've got to question that. Given my years as a narcotics prosecutor, obviously our interdiction policy was a tremendous failure. And in terms of the banking crisis, I don't see how the significant and escalated penalties for banking fraud made any difference in solving the savings and loan crisis.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Laura is calling from Gays Mills, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, the comment I have to make, I guess, could be considered kind of naive, but and it's not anything that's likely to happen, but it's something that I'd like to see happen. Is all right if I mention it?
Go right ahead. No, I...
Okay. Well, and I don't mean this in any personal to anybody present on your show or anybody else, but I think it's really most of this to me is really a class issue. I think the previous caller from Minnesota hit on it with her story. I won't repeat it, but there's a lot of real people who have given real money to people who've been making imaginary things out of it. And I think it's a lot about people who have more money than can even be imagined and people who have maybe enough, you know, and maybe not. And I think that I'll try and get here quick.
Yeah, okay.
I just see that the lawyers have as much money and as much stake in this system as anybody, as the people they defend. They make laws and then they create the paper trails and follow them and do the litigations, and the money keeps going around the same circles.
Laura, what do you think should happen to executives?
Well, I was just about to get there, that I would really like to see that, among other things, they really would have to face going to jail with real people, not just a country club jail, but with real people that get put in jail for all the other laws.
So you would challenge Mark Seltzer's view on deterrence, because he was saying that in fact his experience as a drug prosecutor was that it didn't, you know, hard time didn't really deter drug runners.
Well, they didn't think they'd ever have to
But what you're saying is that white collar criminals facing the prospect of, you know, if he's in New York, he's going to do 6 years in Attica.
Yeah.
And a CEO might well think twice about certifying something he isn't sure about. Mark?
I agree.
Yeah, you agree. That's Jennifer Arland in Santa Monica. Do you want to pick up the point, Jennifer?
Well, with drugs are very different than white collar crime. If you could be sure that you were really convicting someone who was truly guilty of a crime, you know, so we take care of some of the concerns Mark had earlier, then it's absolutely right that they should have to go to jail and do real time, and that would be a deterrent. And it also sends the right signal. These people have hurt people. They have hurt people very badly. They've taken away their life savings, and they should have to pay a criminal penalty that, you know, goes along with how egregious this crime is. And I think these crimes are worse than many of the other crimes we've been talking about, since many of these other crimes are committed by people who aren't at the top of the heap. Whereas if these CEOs have committed crimes and the chief financial officers, they have everything. They're multi-millionaires, and they committed these crimes in order to become more multi-millionaires. It's unspeakable.
Mark Seltzer.
I mean, I think the issue is, do we look at punishment as a deterrent or punishment as a sanction in and of itself? And the question is, ultimately, Congress doesn't have full control over what sentences are meted out in the courtroom. It's the judge following the federal sentencing guidelines. And the challenge is, will the Sentencing Commission amend the guidelines to take into consideration these various aggravating factors, the impact on innocent victims, for example? So ultimately, I think the pressure will be on the courts and on the Sentencing Commission to make sure that sentences that ultimately are applied in a way to make innocent shareholders whole, to put the burden on executives who are charged and convicted to make full and complete restitution.
Jack, we're coming up to the break, but what's your view on this point?
Well, you know, to get to an unspeakable example, at Enron, a woman, I forget her name, but she had $600,000 in savings. And she went, and after he had heard from Sharon Watkins about the imminent collapse of the company, Ken Lay gave them a pep talk, and he says, Enron is the place to put your money. She put all her money in her company, believing in it. And in November, she did this in August, in November she got $20,000 from $600,000. And now, I heard a report the other day, she can't pay her air conditioning bill in Houston. Now, that's an example of the unspeakable kind of class warfare this man perpetrated on this woman's whole future. And there has to be a punishment to fit that crime. One just feels the need of it. But law is law. And
hard time in a state prison, Jack?
Well, Richard Whitney, the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, went to Sing Sing for 3 years in the 30s.
Stay with us, Jack Beatty. Stay with us, Mark Seltzer, Jennifer Arlen. Stay with us, listeners. We're going to talk more about white-collar crime and punishment. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about the about corporate crime and the fitting punishments for those who are ultimately convicted of it under new legislation passed by Congress this week and to be signed by President Bush tomorrow. We've been hearing that the prospects of individuals actually getting that far, where they might be having a sentencing hearing, are actually pretty slim. But we've been talking about some broader subjects as well related to crime and punishment. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Forrest is on the line.
Hi. I'm intrigued by the comments from the woman who talked about all the money she had lost in the market. And in any great loss, which is a tragedy, we're looking for individuals to blame. But a lot of the reason that woman has lost a lot of money is because the market went to absurd valuations as part of essentially a bull market conspiracy in which a lot of people participated, most notably Alan Greenspan, who you know, knew that the market was hopelessly overvalued at 6,600 on the Dow, allowed it to go to 11,000 plus, and then when it collapses says, oh, it's all because of individual corporate crime. I'd simply like to say that in when you have a major valuation gap like this, it's not only the really bad apples who've led to people losing real money, but it's a broad chorus of people who participated in the orchestration of an extreme bull market and the inevitable collapse.
Any comments on Forrest's idea there? It's a little bit off the idea of punishment. Forrest, I just wonder if you have some prescription. Do you see that clear execution of the laws might act as a deterrent on this kind of from above kind of insider view?
I think they would, and I think individuals going to jail is going to make a great difference in the case of white-collar crime in the way that it does not necessarily in the case of the prosecution of narcotics, to take that example, because people who are actually doing pretty well financially as it is are really going to be frightened about the possibility of going to jail if that would remarkably change their lives in a way that those people who are pushing narcotics would not.
Okay. Mark, do you want to comment on that?
I would only point out that policy. These seem to be policy questions, and not necessarily questions that are susceptible to resolution in our criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system. I know I'm talking platitudes here, but our criminal justice system is an adversarial system. It's not based on the search for truth. While a grand jury investigation, while the prosecutors do try to reach the truth, the fundamental truth, they usually don't get there. The adversarial process doesn't necessarily cause all the evidence to be disclosed to a jury. A jury's role is basically to determine whether there's guilt or lack of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not to solve these very complex policy questions. And I wonder whether Congress has shirked their responsibility by looking to the criminal justice system, to looking to prosecutors, to looking to regulators to solve these issues when there are some underlying issues that require, it seems to me, policy resolution.
Yeah, and I just want to add, I think that's a very sophisticated analysis, bull market conspiracy, because, you know, we are now finding out that investment bankers, while they were on the one hand giving euphoric, manipulatedly euphoric representations of stock to the public, were on the other hand deploring the quality of the stock as dogs, and were only doing that because they were in a conflict of interest. They were also taking another part of the investment company, was dealing with the IPO of the company. So that was, in fact, I think, a bull market conspiracy, and this does get to the point of the people who were manipulating the euphoric. The euphoria and the default of intelligence. John Kenneth Galbraith, in his book on the 29 crash, says that speculation buys up the available intelligence.
I would only say in response that, again, a conflict of interest, it's not a crime. And a violation of a rule is not a crime. Even a violation of a fiduciary duty, a fiduciary obligation, that is not a crime.
But it is a crime if an executive knowingly misstates, knowingly makes a material misstatement, and if the WorldCom executives did what it appears they did, which was to treat operating costs as a capital expenditure, that's a crime. And a number of these executives, if they did what it's, they're accused of having done, which is to knowingly lie, that's a crime under the law as it is now, and the current sentencing guidelines would permit real jail time. It's just the prosecutors haven't used it. I agree with the comment earlier that you shouldn't send people to jail too often. You shouldn't do it if you're unsure. But many of these crimes are not radically different than, you know, we don't have more uncertainty than we have in some murder cases, where we're not really sure who did it. And we do the best we can, and we make mistakes, sometimes serious mistakes. But you don't hear people saying we shouldn't send people to jail for murder because we might make a mistake. We try not to.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Virginia is on the line.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to say that it is very obvious to the individuals out here in Middle America that there's been theft. And it's also obvious to us that we can see who perpetrated the theft, and we can see that they still have their ill-gained money, and it's easy to find their ill-gained money. You can tell where they were working. You can tell what they were doing with their time, and there's the money right there. Why is it that we can't get together in class action suits and be guided in this direction to get that money back as restitution? It shouldn't be that complicated. We know where they worked, and we know what they did. What's so complicated?
I throw that question to the lawyers on my panel, Jennifer Arlen and Mark Seltzer.
From a criminal prosecution perspective, remember, you've got to prove the crime by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, almost to a moral certainty. That's the first question, the first issue. The second issue, you've got to establish what was the state of mind of the defendant at the time. I would counsel those not to rush to judgment here, simply because were substantial losses on the stock exchange, simply because the innocent shareholders have lost a lot of money. That doesn't necessarily translate into a crime. Simply because we can identify assets that may be the proceeds of substantial gains that were incurred in the stock market, that by itself is not a crime. 2 or 3 years from now, when the rush to judgment is over and there is some pensive deliberation going on, that's when these cases will be brought to a jury of 12 of your peers. And those peers, not in this kind of atmosphere, but 2 or 3 years from now, when this publicity is long forgotten, will be carefully considering the evidence, and they'll be faced with those kinds of hurdles. So I would just caution the caller to consider if it was your husband or your beloved who was sitting in that chair facing a jury, you would want them to have the same kinds of constitutional protections as you would hope that you would have if you were sitting there yourself.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Susie is calling from Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts.
Hi, good evening. Here's my question. I have actually two small ones. First of all, Harvey Pitt, who thinks he's highly qualified to be the SEC chairman, whereas many people think he is the Dracula guarding the blood bank or something. Mm-hmm. And he has been defending him, and Bush is defending him very strongly. Now, I've heard him at least twice on television in his defense saying why he should keep the job. It's twice I've heard him say, I know where the bodies are buried. Now, my two questions are, one, why isn't he forced then to tell where the bodies are buried? Not literally bodies, obviously, but corporate shenanigans. And secondly, is it possible that Bush is trying to keep him happy with that job so that he won't tell the people where Bush has buried some bodies?
Jack, what do you think? Jack Beatty.
Well, that last question about Bush's own record, you know, when you look into the SEC investigation of Bush, I believe in 1991, 92, in there, that investigation was conducted by an officer who was Bush's former lawyer in the Texas Rangers deal. So in other words, he was being investigated by an SEC appointee who was his former lawyer. And that man didn't talk to him in the investigation. And no one talked to other principals in Harkin Oil. So, yes, one really wonders what those – and, you know, Cokie Roberts said on NPR that he had been exonerated. He has not been exonerated. And Noah Adams actually had a quote it saying – this a letter from the SEC to, I guess, Bush's lawyer saying this is in no way to say that he was exonerated.
Jennifer Arlen, are there no rules regarding recusal in the SEC?
There are rules regarding recusal, but then there's a period of time after which the conflict of interest is deemed to no longer operate, as in fact is the case with Harvey Pitt, who, you know, is coming – or I believe has just crossed the deadline where he can now start investigating the very accounting firms he used to work for. And it's assumed he no longer has a conflict when, in fact, you know, often one still feels, you know, has more ties to people you used to work for than you would if you were truly independent.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Richard is on the line.
Well, gentlemen, you finally got around to the good topic. Our leaders, the very leaders of our society, our democratic society, are playing these same games. You just talked about Bush and Cheney. How about our Secretary of the Army, who got $20 million, I think it was, from Enron, when we now know Enron didn't have the money to pay him. And he considers himself that he shouldn't resign his job? Guys, you don't need that lawyer on your show talking all the double talk. Nothing's going to happen. We're just going to talk away through this like we do everything.
Now, Mark Seltzer is the lawyer I think you're referring to. Now, Mark, do you want to come back on that?
I guess the question from my perspective
is, where
are we going to be 3-4 years from now when you've got lonely prosecutors trying these cases in the courtroom? Are they going to be out there in the wilderness by themselves? Will the press be focusing on the next policy issue of the day? Will the FBI be fully supporting them? Will the law enforcement agencies will be fully supporting them? Will there be congressional pressure for these prosecutions? That, to me, will be the test.
Richard, let me ask you, are you likely to lose interest? We've had a couple of callers saying, well, we need to have class action suits. Would you be willing to get involved in that kind of thing?
I'm still wondering why we haven't reversed the election from when Richard Nixon cheated. Am I going to go away? No, sir, but I'm going to be, myself and others will be a real voice in the wilderness, not the voice in the wilderness that the attorney speaks to of the prosecutors. All of us little people, after these big people walk away with their bundles, will be just as unheard as we are today.
Well, Richard, you're being heard now, and I want to thank you for your call. We've got just enough time to quickly talk about punishment. And is punishment the same thing as justice? Now, this should be like a series of books, but we're going to have to do it quickly. Jennifer Arlen, in your view, we've been talking about punishment. Is punishment the same thing as justice?
Certainly the punishment the law metes out is not necessarily the same as justice. I mean, justice in this case would involve, among other things, the executives who have committed wrongs to the extent they did, accepting responsibility and bearing the financial burden of it. And our system is not really designed to have that happen. And I do believe in shaming. And to the extent these people committed crimes, they should have to bear the shame of that.
Jack Beatty, a final thought from you as we wind down this hour. Shaming sufficient as punishment, in your view?
Well, if we can get it. I mean, but, you know, they go before the committees and they just take the fifth. But to this day, Michael Milken means only one thing to every American. The guy was a crook. He's done all these good works. It's not going to expiate what he did. Boesky, crook. Enron, I mean, you know, Ken Lay, crook. So, yeah, they have suffered. Their reputation is what it should be.
Jack Beatty, I want to thank you for that. And joining us as ever, Jennifer Arlen, law professor at New York University, was with us from Santa Monica, California. With me in the studio, Mark Seltzer, former federal prosecutor, now representing corporate executives. Thank you for the detailed information, Mark. It was very, very helpful. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.